that especially as the colleges are nearing nearing normality, or at least working toward it, and we'll find out a lot about that from Phil Baldwin, who is the conductor of the Whitworth Symphony Orchestra, who will be conducting a concert which comes out on Sunday night, a concert of music of women composers. But when I say Whitworth and when I say women composers, that naturally takes us to the subject of one of the longstanding times we've spent together here on the radio, which is Judith Shefflin and her series, Women Composers, The Untapped Source. And so first, to Judith, good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank
you. And let's take it back. When did you start doing Women Composers, The Untapped Source?
Well, I actually had to do a little research on that. 1993. And I started somewhat by accident, but was able to get a humanities grant for a couple of years to do some various things with women composers, including illustrations, a variety of things to make it truly a humanities project.
And in 1993, it was weird. It was rare. It was unusual. You were a relative pioneer.
Well, I certainly was not one of the initiators of it, but definitely trying to find information, trying to find scores. We didn't have Wikipedia. We didn't have the we were about two books that had some references to major women composers, but it's so different today and so much easier to find information on just these women that are going to be performed on Sunday evening.
And fortunately, it's no longer a bizarre curiosity or something like that, as it was then, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Most people, even good musicians, were pretty much dismissing the whole idea of women composers.
But you championed on and out of that beginning. You've most years, just a very few years that you haven't done it, you've created a concert. Just randomly, what are a few of the topics or focuses that you've done of some of these concerts over the years?
Well, we've had French chamber music. We've had a lieder. We've had a history of art song, starting back with Cassia back in 800 AD. We've had African-American women composers. We've had two piano music. Phil and I did a violin piano one. We've done one that featured flute. A wide variety of subject matter or thematic material, and I'm still thinking.
Yeah.
There are many, many themes out there that I would like to be able to do.
And in the history of this, let's see if I can get on some shaky ground here. It's been that many of the women's music pieces were small chamber pieces, for probably several reasons you can illuminate, and orchestral works were, and large-scale works were rarer. Talk about that legacy and that reason.
Well, it's obvious that if you are in a household setting, which is where most women composers were, you have access to your keyboard and your voice, but you don't have access to a large ensemble. And so it wasn't really until pretty much the 19th century that we start to see some orchestral works being written. And in the 20th century and beyond now, we see women who not write anything for piano, for example, which has been the most obvious instrument. Mm-hmm. They're writing for wind symphonies and operas and symphonic literature.
But that, of course, involves then convincing an orchestra to play it, and
exactly.
Then you're running against a lot of inertia.
But we have women, you know, now who have won a Pulitzer Prize in music and things like that. So they are, at least in certain circles, getting notice. Yeah. And, of course, there's some very wonderful works out there, large-scale works. But it is a challenge even for male composers. Obviously, you have access to, as I say, an instrument or two instruments or voice, but to be able to write for a large ensemble and have it performed is going to be much more challenging.
And Judith Shefflin, the creator of the entire series, Women Composers, The Untapped Source. And to Phil Baldwin, the conductor of the Whitworth Orchestra and violinist, violin teacher there. First, before we kind of answer where this thread is going, the brief history of the last 13 months of what, total shutdown to trying to little by little figure out how to build an orchestra program back up through the cautions and fears of pandemic.
Yes, well, it's been quite a journey. And I think, for the most part, I feel really successful in what we've done. So I'd like to sort of thank our Whitworth administration for working so carefully with the local health authorities and that sort of thing to craft a plan. We call it Whitworth Flex. And so a large number of classes on campus are kind of a hybrid teaching model. So the students will come to class some days and participate online other days. But because of the large music rooms that we have to rehearse in, we have been able to rehearse in person. And various strategies have worked between Wind Symphony and orchestra. The choir actually is rehearsing 10 feet apart in our large atrium. So we've all found creative ways to make this work. But I guess maybe the most amazing thing is the resilience of musicians, the resilience of students, and the fact that no one has been infected through class participation on campus, as far as I know.
That's a nice legacy to be able to say. So then, as you put an orchestra together and created programs, talk a little bit about maybe how life hasn't just been the normal play an overture, play a Beethoven symphony, play a nice concerto, and go home.
Exactly. Well, because of the number of the limitation on the number of people we can have in the rehearsal rooms, I've had to look for much smaller works and try and limit the number of wind and brass players. So our fall concert involved a lot of string music with a few winds and brass. But when we got the idea of doing the Women Composers series, I started looking around for what we could do, and I also wanted to bring back in the winds and brass. I didn't want them to completely forget about their education in that way. And so I spent a ton of time researching what might be possible. And I think we came up with just an amazing lineup of music to perform, people that musicians don't know off the tip of their tongue, and students certainly haven't encountered before. So it's been a real learning process for everyone, and it's been fun.
And you say that that the idea, however, for a women's music concert didn't come from Judith.
No, it didn't. It came from the students. Last semester, in fall semester, I did music by African-American composers or composers of African descent. And at the end of the concert season, I asked the students, well, what would you like to tackle next? And they said, we would like to do women composers. And so I said, you're on. Let's do it.
Good. And there's one very prominent woman composer from the early 20th century, Amy Beach, the late 19th, early 20th century, her works mostly from the 20th century, Amy Beach, who has written a few large works. And then there's three other composers less known, and we'll get to them. But I want to kind of pivot back to Judith, Amy Beach, who notably wrote some really great smaller works and a wonderful piano trio and things like that. But she did write, she wrote a piano concerto, as I believe, and then she wrote this symphony. So talk a little bit about Amy Beach and why she was even in a position to be able to write a symphony and maybe get it heard.
Well, Amy Beach, unlike most women in her generation, although, of course, in her generation, she was not known as Amy because that would have been totally disrespectful. She was Mrs. H.H.A. Beach.
Please, thank you.
She married a prominent doctor in Boston, and they had no children. which provided her time and money, which are two vital things if you want to be a composer. She also, of course, was a prodigy. I mean, she started composing at age four. She had synesthesia, very interesting background, but her parents...
Synesthesia, define it. It's really
well,
cool.
Well, in the musical context, it's hearing a key, like the key of A-flat in a color, or pitch, and Scriabin is noted for that, although they didn't hear the same colors for the same notes. But anyway, Amy was allowed, because of time after she got married, to just study scores. Her parents didn't want her studying in Germany, which was the common practice of the day, and her husband didn't want her out performing because she was, of course, an incredible virtuoso. So she studied Brahms and Bach and all of the greats and really taught herself orchestration. Mm-hmm. And as a result, actually wrote several large-scale works and large choral and orchestra works, as well as, of course, many, many piano works and chamber works. And actually, one of the most challenging pieces I've ever played was the Violin Sonata with Phil.
Absolutely.
You know, it's post-romantic style and thick and chromatic. And
she a prominent composer who is on this Sunday night concert. Let's take a little eight-minute break and hear the first movement of her symphony in E minor, known as the Gaelic. Then we'll return to talk a little bit more about the Amy Beach that's being played by the Whitworth Orchestra on the Sunday night concert. And that was just the first movement. That was the first movement of Amy Beach's Symphony in E minor, subtitled The Gaelic Symphony, played by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Carl Kruger. And it's the last movement of that, which is going to be played by the Whitworth Orchestra on that Sunday night concert. Okay, I'll say it. I'm really hoping to get challenged here. Imagine when that came out. Oh, a dainty little woman could write music like that. Is that maybe part of the problem of frankly, that attitude?
Absolutely. And not just for Amy Beach, but when women would write dramatic and emotional material, they were criticized for trying to sound like a man. You know, what were they thinking? And, of course, if they wrote more romantic, sentimental things, oh, yeah, well, that's just feminine. Yeah. So you couldn't win. Even female pianists of the day dealt with much of the same issue. You know, Teresa Carreño, another woman composer, trying to play the Hammerklavier, what was she thinking? That's a man's piece.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, very much a challenge. I think pretty much that has dissipated at this point.
Surely, although one never knows. So Phil, talk a little bit about this last movement that you're doing of this piece.
Well, it's a terribly exciting piece of music. And if your listeners wanted to hear the very end of that first movement, there's a little quote at the end, and that quote becomes the theme of the fourth movement. So it's very thickly orchestrated with lots of counterpoint. Everybody's got something to do. There's some different instrumentation practices that she does, blending, let's say, violas and bassoons more than violas and horns. Clearly, she knew her orchestration, but it is unique, and it's been a lot of fun to rehearse, and also quite complicated. But it's a wonderful piece of music. Energy from beginning to end. Mm-hmm. That's why I wanted to put it on.
One of four pieces on this Sunday night concert. Sunday night at 8:00, and the easy way to access this, the conceptual way, is just to Google Whitworth University Music Department. You'll get to their website, and that will show you how to get to that concert, which is released at 8:00 on Sunday night. And three other composers on here, Louise Ferenc, whom we'll talk about later, Cécile Chaminade, who has one famous piece that I'll probably play at the end of the hour, and then Vivian Fine, who is the one of these composers from our time, right, Judith?
Yes. Actually, the piece that the orchestra is playing was written in 1987. And the year I came to Whitworth, that's why I remember it. but she was born, I think, in 1913.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so she's been around for a while. She's not like a current generation composer, but Vivian Fine. No relation to Irving Fine, I presume.
Not that I could see.
Yeah. And so a little about her. Did she have any success as a composer in her life?
She did, but she's most noted for writing music for Martha Graham.
Oh.
Dance, ballet music, and ballet scores. But she also wrote operas and actually wrote in virtually every genre.
Okay. And this piece, After the Tradition, talk about that. Phil.
Yeah. So the title, After the Tradition, is from a book by Robert Alter. And the three movements of this piece are Kaddish, which is the traditional Hebrew prayer for the dead. And that was written in memory of the great cellist George Finkel. The second movement is My Heart is in the East and I at the End of the West, which is based on a poem, a Hebrew poet who lived in Spain in the 12th century. And then the last movement is kind of the most fun. It's called Hark, Yahweh Causes the Wilderness to Dance. And the entire piece is mixed meter. So it goes from 5/8 to 7/8 and various interpolations of those two meters, some 3/4. And it's I was describing it to the students the other day. I said, you need to make this dance a little bit more. Maybe think of a goat dancing around with one short leg. it's a lot of fun. And one of the interesting things about Fine's music is the historian Henry Brandt noted that no two Fine pieces are alike, either in subject matter or instrumentation. Each new work appears to generate its own style, appropriate to the subject, and there are no mannerisms which persist from work to work. Hmm. And I think if a composer can compose over 140 major compositions and not repeat themselves too much, that is quite a phenomenal feat. But I think it's very listenable. It's certainly outside what the students have ever encountered before. There's some 12-tone.
When was it written?
1987.
That's right. Yeah, I'm sure you said that.
Kind of one of the fun things about it is that it's very palindromic. So you'll get a melody that reads the same forward as it does backward. And she'll start it in different parts of the measure with different divisions of it. And so it's contrapuntal, but it's also palindromic. Very beautiful stuff.
Wow, that sounds pretty neat. Cécile Chaminade, who is really famous for one flute piece that all flutists play, and it's on every flute competition and everything like that. And yet I found very little of her other music there. Talk about, Judith, the extent of her composition.
Well, she certainly wrote more piano literature than anything else. Over 400 compositions. Mm. And what's really phenomenal is that almost every one of those were published during her lifetime. She became very popular.
And that was French early 20th century.
Yes.
Right? Was that a better time for women within the civilization there?
There was some interest in, obviously there were what we call salon composers in that era, which were very popular to the audiences and to people playing at home. And, you know, I think of the Etude magazine, for example. But she wrote way beyond just salon music, of course. But that was a very popular style, and therefore she became very popular in the United States, even though she was French. She also was concurrent with Amy Beach. They died in the same year, 1944. Mm-hmm. So there were Amy Beach societies around the country and Chaminade societies, mostly made up of women who liked their music and met and things that women often don't have time to do today. But her piano music, of course, is still fairly popular. It just depends. You're looking at a variety of styles, but she's written some incredibly wonderful pieces.
Nice. And how do you pronounce the name of the piece that you're playing that's on the concert?
Judith has researched this, so.
As best we can tell, is called Lear Hoy Suite.
And what's the derivation of that? Does it represent any ethnic vibe in the piece?
I couldn't find much on that at all, so I can't really answer that.
From the inside, do you have a feeling of any ethnic background to this piece?
I'm not sure where the legend comes from, but this is a ballet suite. Mm. I didn't find a good sort of description of the entire ballet, but the gist of it is that Hoy is a princess, and she's captive to Alcmaeon. And at one point, it's kind of like the Faust legend, I guess. She transgresses, and Venus turns her into a statue, but Alcmaeon turns her back and marries her and wins her heart. So, typical fairy tale kind of ballet. But this music is spectacular. If you don't come away from this having a great appreciation for what Chaminade could do orchestrally, melodically, in other words, creating some atmospheres as you would do in a ballet, then you've really missed it, because this is a major piece of music, and I love it. I just cannot tell you how much I've enjoyed rehearsing this and listening to this music. We're leaving the one movement off. It just involved a little too much brass for us to fit in, and that's the pas de cymbals, which has an Arabian feel. But the prelude is just so beautiful and atmospheric, and the scarf dance is probably one of her most famous pieces. Just delightful. And the scherzettino is just this kind of Mendelssohnian light, Midsummer Night's Dreamish piece. And again, it's just amazing music.
The composers who are on this Sunday night Whitworth concert of women composers. And finally, you've been raving about her quite a bit here on off mic, Louise Frank. Let's bring her into the conversation.
Well, she's the earliest composer. She was born in 1804 and rose to...
So more or less Clara Schumann time,
She rose to prominence in France as a incredible pianist, first of all, and teacher, and became what they call basically fully ranked female professor at the Paris Conservatory, which was highly unusual in that era. And along with all her compositions and her fine pianism, she and her husband was a publisher, and she continued this after he died for about 3 years, I think it was in 1832, compiled an anthology, which you can still get, of 300 years worth of keyboard music. So we're talking about 300 years prior to 1832. We don't really think about keyboard music going back that far. And we often start with maybe late Renaissance or early Baroque or something, but it was a major accomplishment, scholarly accomplishment.
And the piece involved here, this is kind of an expanded chamber piece?
Yeah, so this is the Nonet. And this was, in many ways, her most famous piece, and partly because Joseph Joachim was the violinist who was featured on this original performance. And so there's an interesting, I guess, an interesting outcome of that. Frank was a member of the Paris Conservatoire, but she was only allowed to teach women pianists and kind of the lesser composers. But Joachim loved her music so much that he bargained for her and got her salary raised up to the level of the male composers and teachers there.
Wow, breaking the glass ceiling.
The glass ceiling. Yeah. Kind of, if you listen to this piece, you wouldn't know necessarily that it was written for Joachim until the very end of the fourth movement, which is what we're doing. There's just this outrageously fast and difficult passage for the violin. It just comes fleeting out of nowhere. Fortunately, we have a wonderful violinist to play it, Elizabeth Hamilton, who was in your studios yesterday playing part of her piano recital. The piece is originally scored for a wind quintet and a string quartet, but I fashioned a second violin part out of some clarinet bits and viola bits, and just to give the second violin something to do. I think it comes off very successfully. It's a great piece of music. People will enjoy this.
And so that's music from the midnight, or even the first half of the mid-19th century by Louise Frank. Well, thank you. A wonderful journey we've had through this Sunday night concert, the Whitworth Orchestra, 8 o'clock, of women composers, The Untapped Source. So thank you to Phil Baldwin, and especially to Judith Shefflin for, an elapsed 28 years of really important work in doing this. Feels kind of good, doesn't it?
It does.
To have accomplished this?
I would love to live long enough to do another 28 years of it. I just have so many ideas.
Write them all down and send them on to the next person to
do.
That's what one does. Well, thanks
Thank you for having us.
What a treat.
Yeah, definitely.